Random followed the local into a dimly lit tunnel, barely wide enough for two men to walk abreast, and so low he had to keep his head bowed to avoid banging it on the roof. Roof and walls were both made of metal, crudely polished in places, and it occurred to Random that he'd seen nothing else on this planet, except snow. He could hear Storm and Ruby following close behind. He glanced back, but Storm seemed to be holding up okay. It was discernibly warmer in the tunnel. The warmth slowly rose as they made their way on, until finally they emerged into a steel cavern some 20 by 30 feet. The walls had been jaggedly cut from the many layers of compressed scrap metal covering the planet's surface, and no efforts had been made to disguise or cover this. There was no furniture, and the only light came from scattered candles in glass jars. A central metal brazier contained brightly glowing coals, and Storm headed straight for it, with his hands outstretched. Random and Ruby joined him, though a little less quickly, for pride's sake. They both kept one hand at a time, unobtrusively near hidden weapons. Random hadn't lasted this long by trusting people who just happened to turn up at a meeting place. He should have insisted on a password, but there hadn't been time. Random liked passwords. They appealed to his sense of the dramatic. Tall John stripped off an outer layer of furs to reveal a tall, rangy man with long dark hair, a steady gaze, and a mouth set in a stern line. Beside him stood another of the figures from the storm, pulling open her furs, to reveal a short, chunky woman with a great mane of knotted dark hair above a pale, round face. She flashed the three newcomers a broad smile and nodded to them amiably. Like Tall John, time and the world had used her hard, and she could have been any age at all.
"I'm Throat Slitter Mary. Don't mind Tall John. When you get to know him, he's really a pain in the ass. He and I will speak for the others. You'll meet them later. You're welcome here, but I have to say you're not what we were hoping for. We need reinforcements, weapons, supplies, and lots of them."
"We didn't expect two old men and a bounty hunter."
Random shrugged, not upset. "There's more to us than meets the eye. And if you can convince us of the strategic importance of your needs, you'll get everything you could hope for. So talk to us. Fill us in on what's been happening on Technos 3. Your initial contact was intriguing, but short on detail."
"All right. Short and to the point. Like me. We're fighting a trench and tunnel war with the Empire forces. At the center of everything is a factory, getting ready to mass-produce the new star drive. Around the factory lies a series of trench circles. The Empire controls the inner trenches, we control the outer, and we spend most of our time fighting over the ones in the middle. There's maybe 15,000 of us left. There used to be a lot more, but the years have whittled us away. We're all that remains of the original colonists of Technos 3. Our ancestors were indentured workers, paying off the cost of their transport by terraforming the planet and establishing industries. Theoretically, once all the debts were paid off, Technos 3 was theirs. Only somehow there were always more debts for each new generation. The original company in charge went broke. Others came in and took over, running the planet as a business while they asset-stripped it. The companies came and went, but we stayed. We had to. Our ancestors had been genetically altered to enable them to survive on this world. Terraforming can only do so much. If you three stay here long enough, this planet will kill you in a dozen subtle ways. We can't leave this world without some pretty basic changes in our body chemistry, which we've always been denied. Officially, because it would be too expensive. Besides, where else were they going to find such a useful, trapped workforce? As companies came and went, each more cheapjacked than the one before, leaving their failures behind them to poison the land, the whole surface of the planet gradually disappeared under deserted factories in high-tech junk. Right up until today. The Campbells were a bunch of bastards, but the Wolfs are worse. They don't give a damn for this planet. All they care about is their precious factory. Everything else has been left to rust and rot. We've inherited a world dominated by deserted mile-long factories, abandoned construction sites, and worked-out mines. The Wolves, and the Campbells before them, chose this planet precisely because it's such a mess. They could do anything they liked here, and no one would give a damn. Who's going to care about pollution on a world like this? It's already been poisoned so thoroughly that only native life like us could survive here. And no one cares about us. At first, we were an embarrassment. Now, we're rebel terrorists. Life on this planet has been driven underground. We survive, together. We live off the remaining flora and fauna, and they live off us when we're not fast enough. But our time is running out. Once the wolves have got their factory up and running, they'll be able to afford armies of mercenaries to force us back so they can build more factories. And once that happens, they won't stop till we're extinct. We have to stop this factory coming online. It's our only hope.
Sounds straightforward enough. It's a regrettably common scenario in the Empire these days, though this is perhaps a more extreme case than most. Tell me about the weather. I gather it's rather unusual here.
That's one way of putting it. Ever since the Cyberrats screwed up the weather satellites over 200 years ago, the seasons here have lasted exactly 2 days, over and over again. The planet's various owners have been trying to repair the satellites for decades, with no luck whatsoever. Most life here couldn't adapt and died out. What little did survive did so by being extremely tough and not a little eccentric. During the winter, anything with any sense hibernates. In the spring, everything wakes up, explodes, and proliferates. They live, fight, and breed in the summer. Then they feed exhaustively and build nests in the autumn, deep down, away from the razor storms and the hurricanes. Then they sleep through the winter so they can wake in the spring and do it all again. Life here is nothing if not adaptable. It's had centuries of practice. And that's Technos 3, in a nutshell. Perfect for vacations. Bring the kids. Of course, the war ignores such trivialities as the seasons. It goes on day in, day out, whatever the weather. You've arrived as autumn turns to winter. The nearest we've got to a quiet time. Our people in the Wolf Marks take the opportunity for a breather, plan our revenges, and bury our dead. But don't think you can relax. You've got maybe 2 hours before the killing starts again. So welcome to hell, gentlemen and bounty hunter. Maybe now we can get to the important questions, like, when are the others coming? How large an army can you supply us with? How many weapons?
Storm and Ruby both looked at Random. He sighed and met the rebel's gaze as calmly as he could. I'm afraid there isn't any army. Not yet. The Underground is raising volunteers for the Great Rebellion on hundreds of worlds, but it's a long, slow process. Such trained men as we have are scattered across the Empire, where they can do the most good. For the moment, we are all you're getting.
I don't believe I'm hearing this.
Tuljan's voice shook with barely suppressed anger.
We were promised battle-hardened fighters, led by the legendary Jack Random, the professional rebel. And what do we get? Two old men and a professional backstabber. Give me one good reason why I shouldn't just throw the three of you out into the winter to freeze.
Random snatched the gun out of Tuljan's hand, lifted him off his feet with one hand, and pressed the gun under the rebel's chin. Tuljan's eyes bulged as his feet kicked a good foot above the floor. Before the surrounding rebels could react, Random put Tuljan down again and offered him his gun back. The rebel leader took it automatically and blinked confusedly. The rebels looked at each other uncertainly. Throat Slitter Mary was grinning. Tuljan pulled his dignity about him again and nodded curtly to Random.
Not bad for an old man.
There's more to us than meets the eye.
There would have to be. Well, if you're all we're going to get, we'd better make the most of you. Come with me, and I'll introduce you to a few of our strategists. Ragged Tom and Spectre Alice should have a few ideas. They usually do.
Interesting names you have here. Hasn't the concept of surnames made it this far yet?
Our ancestors were indentured workers, slaves in all but name. They just had numbers. We're free, so we choose our own names, or accept those given to us by others. Surnames are for people with families and a future. We live from day to day, and depend on no one but ourselves. There's no room for luxuries on Technos 3.
In a small private gymnasium in the great hulking residential building attached to the factory, Michael Wolf, reluctant husband to Stephanie, was working out on the parallel bars. Michael hated every minute of it. It was entirely too much like hard work, and if he'd wanted to work hard, he wouldn't have married into the aristocracy.
What's the matter, Wavo?
Michael looked around quickly. Lily Wolf, reluctant wife of Daniel, was standing in the open doorway, striking another of her poses. This was her favorite, one leg forward, chest out, head slightly back, designed to pull his eyes up her body, showing off her 6'6" willowy frame, from her incredible legs all the way up to her pouting mouth.
What brings you here, Lily? I didn't think you even knew this place existed. And I've told you before, don't call me lover in public. It's not safe.
Lily shrugged.
There's only one kind of exercise I've ever been interested in. Anything else is just a waste of good sweat. And I've never been interested in being safe, either. Now, are you going to come over here and kiss me, or am I going to have to come and get you?
Michael draped his towel over one shoulder and moved unhurriedly over to join her. It was important to him that he kept some kind of control, even though he knew he'd lose it all the moment he took her in his arms. He had to tilt his head up to kiss her. He was a good 6 inches shorter than her, but that had never bothered him. It just meant that there was that much more of her for him to love. He belonged to her, body and soul, even though he knew he'd probably end up dying for her if they were ever found out.
This complex may not be as openly bugged as we're used to, but that doesn't mean somebody couldn't be watching us. That bug scrambler of yours has its limits. Daniel and Stephanie may be so preoccupied with getting this factory up and running that we're being allowed a longer leash than usual, but we still have to be careful.
You're so boring when you're being sensible. But for once, I agree with you. I came here to talk. Daniel and Stephanie have a great deal invested in this factory's success. If they were to fail, if something were to go wrong here, they'd have even less time to pay attention to us. Yes, I thought you'd like that. Now, let's take the argument one step further. If they were to die here, you and I would inherit all their worldly goods and their position in the family. And considering that dear Constance doesn't give a damn about the family and never has, and dear Valentine is a complete lunatic whose regular intake of dubious chemicals would suggest he isn't wrong for this world anyway, if we were to play our cards very carefully, we could end up with everything.
And we could end up very dead. Kill them? Are you crazy? You've been thinking again, haven't you? I hate it when you think. Our position is precarious enough as it is. Arranging a plausible accident for the factory is one thing, but if Daniel and Stephanie were to die, whatever the situation, the first people they'd arrest would be me and you, precisely because we have so much to gain. And you can't lie to an Esper.
Unless the deaths could queerly be put at someone else's door. Someone who hates them even more than we do. Like the local Webbles, perhaps. You see, I have friends here, dear Michael. Good friends. Powerful friends.
Who the hell are these friends of yours?
Quan Chojiro. I've been one of their agents for ages now. They respect my witchy nature, and they pay very well. They had a great many agents in place here already, but through me, they now have access to all kinds of Webbles they couldn't even touch before. They're quite willing to see we get everything we want, as long as they get what they want. They even have agents among the local Webbles, feeding them information. Honestly, things couldn't be working out better for us, could they?
I don't know. I need time to think about this.
Well, think quickly. Someone will be coming here to talk to us any minute. The last piece of the puzzle has just arrived.
I assume we're talking about a double agent. What makes him so special?
He's a Jesuit commando,
said a calm voice behind them.
Which means he has access to all the security systems in and around the factory complex.
Michael spun around, fists clenched at being caught unawares, and then he quickly unclenched them as he remembered who he was facing. The Jesuits were the enforcers of the Church of Christ the Warrior, and were said to be the best fighters you could find, outside the investigators or the arena. This particular Jesuit was wearing purple and white battle armor, and a sardonic smile. He was tall, dark, and not particularly memorable. He didn't look especially tough, either, but Michael had absolutely no intention of testing him, or even upsetting him. Michael's muscles were strictly for show.
So glad you could come and see us. I take it everything is going as planned?
So far. I am Father Brendan, Michael. You may have complete confidence in me. In this room, for example, the security systems are currently running on a closed loop, so we can talk for as long as we need without fear of being overheard. Now, I'm sure you have questions. Ask away.
All right. Let's start with why we should trust anyone from the church. Last I heard, they were still advocating the return of the death penalty for adulterers. This could all be a setup by Kasser. He'd love to have something he could use to bring down the wolves.
The Cardinal knows nothing about this, or we'd all be dead by now. As to why I've chosen to work with Clan Chojiro, it's really very simple. Before I joined the church, I was originally Clan Silvestri.
What the hell do Chojiro and Silvestri have in common?
Blue block.
Michael realized his mouth was hanging open, and closed it with a snap. Blue block. The extremely secret, half-mythical school where younger members of the families were trained and conditioned almost from birth to be utterly loyal to the clans, to death and beyond. The family's secret weapon.
But why is Blue Block being used against the wolves, one of their own?
The wolves in general, and Valentine in particular, are becoming too powerful. He's tipping the balance. We feel it would be best for all if Valentine could be made to stand down, and others more willing to share the profits of Star Drive production took over.
Which is where we come in. Daniel and Stephanie will fall easily without Valentine to protect and support them. Constance will be quietly sidewinded, and we will take over the family. Clan Chojiro will support us now in return for future generosity on our part.
Quite. You don't have to do anything much to begin with. We'll supply explosives and provide exact locations where they'll do the most damage. All you have to do is place them in those areas of the complex that only you have access to. It won't be a particularly big explosion, just enough to throw production into chaos and make Clan Wolf look incompetent.
So no one has to get killed?
Only as a last resort.
All right. When does the balloon go up?
At the ceremony. Live, on holoscreens all over the Empire. It'll be a rating smash.
You see, Wover, everything is planned down to the last detail. Nothing can go wrong.
Toby Schreck hurried down the narrow corridor, glanced at the watch face set into his wrist, and swore quietly. This was officially sleep time in the factory complex's living quarters, and after the day he'd been through, he felt he could sleep for a week. He'd been running himself ragged trying to set up all the interviews and factory footage he could. No one was cooperating except under the direst of threats, and trying to make this factory look good was a task that even an experienced PR flack like himself would have blanched at. Personally speaking, Toby felt he'd seen sexier-looking abattoirs. But none of that mattered now. He had a chance at a once-in-a-lifetime interview, and he was damned if he was going to lose it now, just because it was an hour when all civilized men had their heads down and were dreaming furiously. Everyone else could give him cold shoulders till their joints froze up. This one interview would make his reputation. He tried to hurry himself a little faster, but he was already out of breath. Too much weight. Too many good lunches at PR events and launches. As a result, he was built for comfort rather than speed. All right, he was fat. For once, it didn't matter. No one would be looking at him in this interview. He forced himself on, puffing hard. Trust Flynn to have his quarters halfway across the complex. Actually, that wasn't really fair. Toby had quarters in the better area because he was, after all, an aristocrat, and Flynn very definitely wasn't. Toby finally stumbled to a halt before the right door, leaned on it a moment while he got his breath back, and then hammered on the door with his fist.
Go away! I am resting! If you're factory personnel, go to hell. If you're Toby the Troubadour, go to hell by the express route. If you're a wolf, this is a recording. If you're a potential lover, leave your name and location on my computer file. Full image, please. Close optional.
Open up, dammit! You wouldn't believe who's agreed to talk to us.
Tell him to take 2 aspirin and I'll see them in the morning. I am off duty, and I don't have to talk to anyone I don't want to. If you don't like it, take it up with my union.
Flynn! It's Mother Superior Beatrice of the Sisters of Mercy!
There was a pause, and then the door lock snapped off.
Very well. Come in. But on your own head, be it.
Toby growled something uncomplimentary and very basic, kicked the door open, and stormed in. He managed about 6 steps before he came to a dead stop. The door closed behind him, and the lock clicked shut again. But he didn't notice. Someone could have slipped a live grenade into his underwear, and he wouldn't have noticed. The cameraman's quarters weren't much, being basically cramped and functional, but a few feminine touches had helped to brighten the place up. And the most feminine thing in the room was Flynn, reclining on his bed in a long, flowing cocktail dress with a margarita in a frosted glass in one hand and a book of decadent French verse in the other. He was also wearing a long, curly wig of purest gold and wore subtle but artfully applied makeup. His work boots and sloppy trousers had been replaced by fishnet stockings and stiletto heels, and his fingernails had been painted a shocking pink. All in all, Flynn looked very pretty and completely at ease. Toby closed his eyes and shook his head slowly.
Flynn, you promised me you wouldn't do this. We are not in civilized company now. They would not understand. And the representatives of the Church of Christ the Warrior definitely wouldn't understand. They'd execute you on the spot for deviancy and degeneracy and shoot me as well just for knowing you. Now get out of that gear and into something that won't get us both hanged. Mother Beatrice won't wait forever.
Rush, rush, rush.
Flynn drained the last of his margarita, slipped a bookmark into his poetry collection, and put glass and book carefully to one side before rising gracefully to his feet.
Very well. You wait outside while I change into something less comfortable. And bear in mind, I wouldn't do this for anyone less than Mother Beatrice. That woman is a saint.
Toby stepped outside and closed the door without actually shutting it, so he could continue the conversation or hiss if he saw anyone coming. He shook his head again. He could feel one of his headaches coming on.
Of all the cameramen on all the worlds, I had to end up with you. Why me?
Because you were desperate for a good cameraman, and no one else would work with you. As it happens, I also felt the need to leave in a hurry. My last gentleman admirer was a high-ranking member of the clans, who also liked to dress up pretty in the privacy of his own quarters. Wonderful man, very interested in yodeling. Anyway, we had words and broke up, and he became rather concerned that I might tell all for the right price, and he couldn't have that. If word of his private proclivities were to get out, no one in the families would ever take him seriously again. It's all right to be a degenerate if you're an aristocrat, but not if it's something silly. So, seeing the way his mind was working, I decided it might be in my best interests to leave town for a while, and hole up somewhere suitably distant until he calmed down again, which is the only reason I agreed to work with you, Toby Shrek. You have to realize the word on you was not good. An aging PR flack with dreams of reporting and delusions of adequacy. Nothing personal, you understand. For what it's worth, you're doing all right here. I've worked with worse.
Toby scowled but said nothing. Flynn had most of it right. He'd spent most of his life working as a PR man and spin doctor for Gregor Shrek, despised by his peers and unappreciated by his family. No one realized how much hard work went into good PR. But he'd always dreamed of being a real journalist, digging out the truth and exposing villainy and corruption in high places instead of covering it up. But somehow, he never had the courage to leave the safe haven of his job and family. It took being kicked out to wake his ambitions again. And now that he was here on Technos 3, he was going to do the best damn job he could. It was his chance to be someone in his own right, not just another of Gregor Schreck's shadows. A chance to finally acquire some self-respect. Mother Beatrice was renowned for not giving interviews, and the press corps took it seriously after she kneecapped a reporter with a meat tenderizer when he tried blackmailing a friend into talking about her. But she was probably the only person on Technos 3 who could and would tell him the whole story, the whole truth, and to hell where the shrapnel fell. Toby kicked the doorframe viciously.
Flynn, are you ready yet?
The door swung open, and Flynn strolled out, looking like just another cameraman. The camera perched on his shoulder like a sleepy owl. Flynn did a quick twirl for Toby to show off his baggy trousers and camouflage jacket.
Well, will I pass?
You've still got lipstick on.
Flynn took out a handkerchief, wiped his mouth, and smiled at Toby.
Better?
Fractionally. Now let's go, before Mother Beatrice changes her mind, or somebody changes it for her.
They made their way quietly through the narrow corridors, stopping every time they thought they heard something. No one else was about. Most people were asleep, trusting to the electronic guards and surveillance to guarantee their rest wouldn't be disturbed. After all, the rebels had never got this close on the best day they ever had, and no one in the factory would dare run the risk of upsetting security. As a reporter in charge of making the factory complex look good, Toby had security passes for practically every area, and some discreet but heavy-duty bribes had ensured no one would tell about his little late-night jaunt. He hoped. He led Flynn to the nearest exit in the outer sector, and they stopped to climb into the heavy furs left hanging by the door. Even a short journey through Technos 3's winter could be deadly without the right protection. Toby and Flynn bundled up in layers of fur and wool till they could barely move, and then stumbled over to the exit. Toby looked out the window beside the door and winced. The air was thick with swirling snow, blown this way and that by the gusting wind. He didn't look at the thermometer. He didn't want to know. He pulled his fur hat down low over his brow, wrapped his scarf securely over his mouth and nose, cursed quietly for a moment, and then jerked the heavy door open. It swung slowly inward, revealing a 2-foot drift of snow that had piled up against the closed door. Toby and Flynn kicked their way through it and lurched out into the winter. The door slammed shut behind them, and they were alone in the night. Outside the complex's exterior lights, there was only darkness and the storm. There were supposed to be stars out and 2 small moons, but they were hidden behind the fury of the snows.